Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme.
It wasn't just exhaustion, and it wasn't just that we tried out all options. It was much more than that. It was a slow and gradual realization of the importance of a serious response to a serious problem.
This week, we come to you from the Swiss Alps, where high up in the mountains, we've gathered some of the sharpest minds in business, hospitality, and city living to discuss how the world should move for Monocle's Chiefs Conference. We're going to speak with the woman helping to rewild our cities and connecting urban foresters around the world. Meet a mayor who, following a financial crisis, has been able to turn his city around. Hear from an entrepreneur committed to change the way that we move from A to B, and debate the future of the office and how that will change the places that we call home too. That's all ahead, right here on The Urbanist, with me, Andrew Tuck. So, welcome to this week's edition of The Urbanist. I'm here at Suvretta House in St. Moritz, where we've already had a very packed day. One of the conversations that kick-started the morning was about the future of mobility in our cities. The man sharing his wisdom with us, Petter Nebbe, a serial entrepreneur whose new brand, Comma, is rethinking how we get around in our cities. Petter joined me and our design editor, Nolan Giles, on stage and started by explaining just what sort of vehicle he is creating.
It's not really only one vehicle, even though, yes, this is it, as much as we want to be showing now. But it's this space between cars, electrical scooters, all of that, and the car. That space, we think, needs to be changed. And footprint is incredibly important. Footprint is important because if you can lower or make it smaller, a car can take less space in the, especially in the urban environment, which I think is very important. So, as a Comma is really much grander than one car. It's more about creating tools to take our cities back, to make them really livable, to have much more public spaces rather than all these dead metal boxes sitting and taking, or when they sit, it's kind of possibly positive, but they pass through and they ruin a lot of spaces that we need, and we will need more of them as well.
And it's a brand new concept. And I commute to work in London before I moved to Zurich on my bike. I would often ride past Andrew on the street serendipitously because he lives on the way.
You didn't ride past me. I was going just as fast.
I overtook Andrew. But one thing I'm very conscious of, and I know a lot of commuters are, is looking good on the way to work. So am I going to look good cruising to work in your Comma vehicle? Can you tell us a little bit about the design?
Sure. Yes. I mean, it's, you know, fundamental for me, at least, that, you know, we are human beings. It's not only about a practical compromise just because we want to feel better in terms of, yes, being, whether it's electrical vehicles or using less energy, etc. We are also human beings. We want to connect with what we are using. And I think also that is not to be underestimated in terms of even energy use, because what we do know is that if we connect with an object, it lasts so much longer and we want to hold on to it much longer. So therefore, for me, that design element is super important. And I think I always like that golf analogy. So, you know, how long people that buys a golf holds on to the golf car, Volkswagen car. There's something that when that came out, that design that just, you related to it, and the person who wanted to buy that, he just thought it was good enough, even if there was a new model, which of course became a little bit of a problem. So that's another story, economically meaning. But it's enormously successful because it has this deep understanding of how we as humans are, and we cannot only rely on just immediate gain for the greater good or, let's say, faster to somewhere, but there is this connectivity where design or beauty, I heard mentioned as well. I mean, for me, design is just the industrial extension of beauty, and we need that, and it has to work.
You know, as city residents in a place like London, I think a lot of us have enjoyed the time we've been able to spend on the road during the pandemic, just getting out of the house, being on a bike, and feeling safe on the streets. I'm guessing safety is a big factor for you. You know, people will be returning to our cities. The roads will be busier. It can be scary on a bicycle. How do you deal with the aspect of safety?
Safety is fundamental. And of course, again, I am that man that put things together, and then I rely on smart people to make sure that they know this stuff. And safety is, of course, fundamental. So I always take, you know, when I do things such as this, I think, well, it's not really built for me. I want to build it for Andrew. I want to build
Thank
it for
you.
I will build it for you, you know, or for my wife. You know, I want to make sure that the barriers of entry is so low that you're willing to make that change. And of course, on that hook of, you know, so safety is super important. Well, if it's about viruses and bacteria, that's one element. I'm not so concerned, because whether it's about the safety or being safe in a vehicle that probably is not the kind of vehicle that you imagine being driving. But when you sit there, that safety part is fundamental. And how a good designer can implement that in the simplest way, you know, of course, airbags and all that, all of these basic, but this sense of safety, perception of safety, is also very important to be able to make everyone wanting to adapt to a new footprint of a vehicle in a city.
I think we've all seen that when new modes of mobility come to our city streets, there's often a bit of a standoff. People don't like it, actually. You suddenly see e-scooters on the streets and people are like, I hate these things. I want to kind of like throw them in the river along with the rider. And there's a bit of aggression when another form of mobility comes along. So if you're suddenly introducing this thing that can weave through all the cars, leaving them standing, and you're going past, well, I'm going to be in the front apparently, so weaving around smiling, are you worried about this odd dance that we have around transport and mobility that people might think, I don't like this?
Well, I think, you know, to the e-scooter point, I think it's almost like something that was exciting in the beginning, but then we have seen the effect of it in a larger scale of, you know, seeing an e-scooter just lying there, thrown in a river, does not feel good. You don't have to be Swiss to think that that's wrong, you know. And I do believe on the pandemic side is that I think we will come back and we will be quite similar. We learned a lot, but we will just return relatively to where we were. But what I do see is that maybe a younger generation than the average or sitting around here do have an enormous want to change, and especially on the climate side. So if we can also talk to that generation at the same time, being, you know, the father, me, having something that, rather than having a Ferrari that is beautiful and my son would love to have one too, maybe having, you know, that Kamma bike, because it's so aspirational, because it just, it's so meaningful, because it just delivers on being good around you. And I think that's, you know, our strategy is to build it and everyone will come. We believe so strongly in this that we might fail, but we have to do it because we think we have those elements to make that change. And I don't think pandemic has created any problems whatsoever for that strategy, so to say.
Petter Nebbe there, the founder of Kamma. In a moment, we'll cross to Athens to hear from its mayor on the city's incredible recent transformation. And here's just a little teaser of what Mayor Bakoyannis thinks when it comes to delivering change to a city.
Lyndon Johnson, the president of the United States, apparently in 67 or 68, you know, when everyone was against him because of the Vietnam War, once said that whenever I feel bad about my job, I feel that there is a worse job. I could have been mayor. Which is actually true, and it's actually what's so exciting about what we do. That, you know, a city is a living organism. It's full of surprises. It's unpredictable. And no day is the same as the next one. So what we try to do, at least in Athens, is that we have a very clear strategy about where we want to go. Short-term, medium-term, long-term. We know very well what we want to achieve in the next 2, 4, 6 years. But at the same time, we never underestimate how important it is to deliver on the small incremental changes that can improve the quality of life even a little bit. So, you know, I may be sitting here in St. Moritz talking about tactical urbanism and unifying archaeological spaces, which we are doing. But it wouldn't just be a mistake or an error. It would be a crime for me to forget that I have to make sure that the children in the neighborhood of Makriyani, to mention an example, have a playground, and that our sidewalks need to be repaired in Kolonos. I'm giving you neighborhoods in Athens. Or that we need more asphalt in a street in Pagrati. And that's what's so attractive about our job, that we do both.
More from Mayor Bakayanis later. This is The Urbanist. Climate change is a real threat, no doubt about it, and we all need to do our part in helping reduce the negative effects that city living has on our planet. One option is to help plant and rewild our forests, and Elise van Middelem knows what to do. She left a career as a brand consultant to create Sugi, an app that helps users plant and rewild, connecting them with a community of urban foresters too. She joined Monocle's senior editors Sophie Grove and Ed Stocker on stage and started by telling them where the idea came from.
2018, there was a lot of talk already around, you know, climate change, and a lot of talk. And I felt the necessity of investing in nature and building biodiversity. And so I decided I wanted to plant trees, because in the cities I lived in, the cities I loved most were close to forest. San Francisco has an old growth forest, 15-minute drive. Zurich, I mean, wonderful, you can go swim in the lake like we did this morning. So I went all about researching these tree planting organizations, and I just couldn't figure it out. Like, $1 one tree, like millions of trees. Where are they planted? How are they planted? Are they restoring ecosystems? And then I remembered meeting my friend in India who had reversed completely degraded land by using a very specific technique, a Japanese technique called the Miyawaki method. I'll tell you more about it later. But that technique, in fact, creates ultra-dense biodiverse forest on as little as a space of the stage. And so these pockets that are so dense and 100% natural and native species restore and bring back the biodiversity that is now tip of the iceberg. In the beginning, I mean, it was not always easy. I think one of the challenges is to stick to your values. I mean, for me, it was I want to restore biodiversity or bring back biodiversity and restore ecosystems and not go for $1 one tree. Many people said, why don't you just go for like the million trees or like do the carbon? I said, no, it's the whole thing. Just now, actually, I had a conversation and somebody said, so let's say I have some money and I want to put it on your platform. Like, how many trees would that be and how much carbon? And I said, no, then you wouldn't come to my platform. You would subscribe to build biodiversity and you would know that you're part of that whole ecosystem. Like in the last year and 3 months, we've now 14 forest makers, 25 projects, ranges from 1 hectare in London, 30,000 trees, to a small patch in Queensland, Australia. But they all have a story and meaning, and they're all a necessity for the community. That's how they reached out. And right now, I don't want to do projects that are just far away. They need to be tangible, accessible. If you want to come to and visit one, it's possible.
Yes, please.
Yeah. I mean, come plant.
We were talking before about this kind of a scandal in a sense that non-Indigenous trees are being planted, you know, by people who have very good intentions, but they aren't restoring any biodiversity and there isn't value. In fact, quite the opposite. And I wondered, is your method a response to that? And how do you convince people to really commit to creating a kind of chaos in the middle of a city? I mean, it's very against the sort of mentality, a certain Parisian landscaping and, you know, bushes. People, I wonder how much convincing they need.
It's always the first one, right? I think in everything we do. It's just when they see it and when they see what it brings back, then it's done. But a couple of thoughts in your question. The first one being about the technique. So it's a Japanese technique. Dr. Akira Miyawaki devised this technique. It starts with the soil. You know, it's the idea of by cultivating the soil, you cultivate beauty. We don't put a tree, just dig a hole and put a tree in the ground. It's creating the ecosystem, bring back the fungal network, which is also a really great carbon sink, if you want. And then it's studying the ancient trees. And that's not always easy because it's not going 100 years back. It's going really back. It's literature, seed banks. I mean, some require study. And from that moment, we try and make a calculation on percentages, shrub, subtree, tree, canopy. And on a square meter, you will plant 3 to 5 trees. So it's ultra dense and biodiverse. So very quickly, in 2-3 years, you have a maintenance-free forest. I mean, in Queensland, as you can imagine, in a climate that is so tropical, we have already 2-meter trees, and in 1 year only, it's almost maintenance-free. It's also the species, right? Like some patches, we use 100 different native species. Think about the flowers. Think about the life that comes back there.
Elise van Middelem from Sugi there. The city of Athens has rebounded from the financial crisis and years of uncertainty to become a centre for investment, opportunity, and a place where the diaspora wants to come home to again. So how did it turn around its story? And what lessons does it have for other cities? I was joined on stage by Kostas Bakoyannis, the mayor of Athens, and also by our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. Mayor Bakoyannis told us about the journey that his city has been through in the past decade.
Long story short, we had the biggest economic collapse in peacetime in the history of modern economics. Believe me, it wasn't as exciting as it sounds right now. And in these 10 years, there were times when many of us feared that Athens, Greece, is becoming the new Weimar Republic of the 21st century. There was dramatic unemployment. There were really tense moments because of the socioeconomic inequalities. There was violence in the streets. Things were really, really tough. But somehow we survived. And that's not because of the political system. That's because of the ingenuity and the resilience of the Athenians themselves. And now, after 10 years, if you walk around the streets of Athens, even now during the pandemic, you'll get the sense of an optimism, of a dynamism. You'll get the sense that something's happening here, something's changing. So there are many reasons to feel really good about where Athens is going. It's not just its history, it's not just its location, it's most importantly the people themselves, especially the young Athenians.
Tell me, as some money began to come back into the country, began to come back into your coffers, what are the things that Athenians were asking for to change their city? I was there only a couple of weeks ago. People are very passionate about the city, but also good critics of their city. Many people said, we lack public space. We don't have the kind of network of parks you might find in other cities. You know, we still need more greenery. What's the kinds of things that they came to you when you came into office and they said, they made you aware that this was their checklist for the city?
Well, Athenians are great critics of their city, and they're even better critics of their mayor, which is actually good because it helps us to be more efficient and more effective. If you look at Athens, you can either look at it from bottom up or top down. Bottom up is about going back to the basics. You know, the mayor of Athens is not in a constant dialogue with Pericles. The mayor of Athens doesn't wake up in the morning gazing at the Acropolis and admiring the ancient heritage.
Is this what your morning looks like here? I'm just wondering.
I wish. Yeah. The mayor of Athens and the city, first of all, has to make sure that the city is clean, well-lit, green, and safe. So the first thing we've been doing for the past 1 year is literally reinventing city services, whether it is working inside the city hall and inside the city, or whether it's about outsourcing to actually add more tools to our arsenal. But this is a bottom-up, which is very, very important, but it's part of the story. Then there is a top-down. What we're doing right now is that we're undergoing a transformation. You have all heard, I'm sure, of tactical urbanism or guerrilla urbanism. What we're doing is that we are unifying all the archaeological monuments of the city. And we are creating one big park. It's not just a network to move within the city. It's a big park. And of course, that's not easy because it's a new model of sustainable mobility, which necessitates that many of us will change our habits. And of course, nobody wants to change one's habit. But we're getting there.
Greece has a very deep relationship with tourism. It's important for all of Greece. I know you're building new hotels in Athens as we speak. What's your view on tourism as the world gets moving again. You've been lucky because of the numbers in Greece that you've had a reasonably good summer, but nothing like summers past. What's your take on where the tourism relationship goes for Athens?
Well, let me be as objective as I can. For us, Athens is an idea, first of all. It's much more than the sum of its parts. It's an idea. And it's an idea because it has a soul, because it's an authentic city, because it has its own character. And we want to protect this character. We don't want Athens to become a theme park. We don't want Athens to be sterilized. And we're very, very clear about that. Having said that, Athens last year had 5.5 million visitors. We can do much better than that. I mean, we've still got a long, long way to go. If you look at the numbers, compare Athens to Rome or Paris or Prague or Istanbul, you'll see that there is a lot that we can still do. And we're investing on that. We're investing on attracting visitors through infrastructure. For example, a bit earlier, you showed a picture of a public square with a big fountain. That's Omonia Square. We revamped Omonia Square just a few months ago. What's interesting is not that we did our job and, you know, there's now a lovely water fountain and all that. What's interesting is that what we did in terms of social infrastructure is combined with over 20 new investments, over 20 new hotels around Omonia Square.
When you think about the city and it's been hit by the pandemic, as you say, like other places, but it's shown an incredible resilience getting through that. What are your concerns and worries for the coming months? And also, maybe could you just explain in a few words this notion of there being a new political pact? Because did that come about through people being exhausted of fighting and demonstrating? Did it come about just because the economy ticked up? Or is it a genuine coming together, do you think, of Athenians around a new ambition for their city?
I mean, we have been through hell and back over the last few years. We went bankrupt literally 3 times, or almost bankrupt. We had a referendum that almost brought us on the verge of getting out of the Eurozone in the European Union. My British friends speak about Brexit. Come on, that was nothing compared to what we went through in terms of populism a few years earlier. And we survived. And it wasn't just exhaustion. And it wasn't just that we tried out all options. It was much more than that. It was a slow and gradual realization of the importance of a serious response to a serious problem. That just talking at a problem doesn't work.
And then just on the concerns for the future, the biggest challenges for you, we know there's some tussles at the eastern end of the Med at the moment. Is the geopolitical issue a big thing for you? Is the resurgence potentially of the pandemic more worrying a second time around? What's on your concern list for the 6 months, year ahead?
The resurgence of the pandemic, clearly. Human life is the most important and the most valuable commodity that we have, and the economic and social consequences of the pandemic. These are, I think, the 2 biggest challenges that we face, much like the whole world.
That was Kostas Bakayiannis, Mayor of Athens, and this is The Urbanist. And finally, on today's show, is it all over for the office? Should homes be designed to accommodate us working from there, well, forever? Nora Felbaum is the CEO of furniture powerhouse Vitra and the third generation of her family to run the business. And she sees the trends, needs and challenges firsthand and every day. She spoke to Monocle's Nolan Giles.
That was a question around, will there still be offices? So I think, yes, there will be, but not every office has a reason for being in the future. So let me give you the pro argument and then the con. The pro argument, the one that really sticks with me, is if you think pre-COVID, the last 10 years, we've seen this rise in the freelance economy. I'm sure you've all observed it, maybe also in your company. People wanted more freedom. Companies didn't want to employ people. So this freelance economy just went through the roof. And where did these people work? Did they work from home, most of them? A lot of them went to shared workspaces. So at the same time as we've seen a rise in freelance economy, we've seen a rise of shared workspaces. The Regus's, Spaces, the WeWorks, and all of that, yeah? So if there wasn't a need for the office, why would people go and actually pay not very little money to be in a workspace where they probably actually don't know many people. You know, it's not that they're going there to collaborate, they're going to focus or because it drives them or because they have the routine or something. Yeah. So that's, for me, that's a big argument pro. But again, it's a free decision, it's a conscious decision. I think there's some offices that are just inhumane. And if I think about, I visited my team in London 3 or 4 weeks ago and the subway was empty. I mean, it was really actually quite scary. And we were in the city of London where you have all these high rises and, you know, usually thousands of people go there every day and they get on a subway, they commute for an hour, then they enter these buildings with, you know, 5,000 other people. And then they sit there for 8 hours. And usually that's where the bunny stable came in or the chicken battery or whatever. There's no daylight. There's a battery of desks. They're actually often not even collaborating with each other, but they're sitting behind a screen, which is something that you can frankly do from anywhere. And then at the end of the day, they go take the elevator down and take the subway home again for an hour. I mean, I don't think it's that surprising that people are struggling to get employees back into this sort of environment. That's going to be tough now that people were able to stay at home, save 2 hours of commute, have daylight, and a lot more time with their family. So I think it's not the question, will there be an office or not? It's what type of questions, what do you offer there? And where are those offices? Do they need to be in central London or are they more spread out? There was actually a comment by Eric Schmidt from Google who said that Google is thinking more of a hubs and spokes system where you don't have one office in San Francisco for 10,000 people or even one campus for I don't know how many thousand, but you have, you know, in neighborhoods around where also rents are lower.
As we look at these slides going past, it reminds me of something we've been hearing a lot from COOs, CFOs at the moment, and they talk about, you know, the importance of people, and people are so important, and people make the place, and they make the brand. But I'm wondering, is there also an argument, that's the fashionable one, but what about placemaking people? That if I go into a fantastically designed office, do I sit up, not just because I'm in this chair, but do I sit up a little bit straighter? I am proud of showing my friend comes and visits, a colleague comes and visits, there's an amazing lobby, I've got a fantastic collaborative space where I work with my colleagues. Do we need to be putting more value on place and good place design in terms of, I guess, informing culture and potentially attracting talent?
Short answer, in my opinion, yes, but that's obvious. So at Vitro, we believe that our surroundings influence everything we do. Every minute, every day, we are influenced. These things, they signal something. They signal a certain quality. They signal, you know, that aesthetics are important or not important. And I think every company will have to take a decision for itself. What are our values? What do we want people to think and feel every day when they, clients, but also employees, when they go through our environments? Are aesthetics important to us? Maybe not. Maybe I'm running a company that is super cost conscious and everything I want people to think about is to reduce costs and get my clients the cheapest offer ever. Maybe a Vitro environment is not for them. Maybe actually they shouldn't invest in a fantastic environment. Maybe they should not have an office at all in the future because it's the cheapest. You know, have everybody work from home and come together once a year and, I don't know, at a barbecue.
Who wants to apply to that company in the room?
Yeah, but there are many companies out there that function by those values. So it's not one answer for everybody. But if you believe you have, you know, a brand to sell and you have customers to excite and you maybe have a certain premium offer, then I think your office should really matter to you. And that's the exciting thing about these times. So the order book, not so great right now, but that's okay. We're a family business. We have time. But it's never been so easy to talk on a C-level about workspace. Everybody, it's one of the top three concerns right now, is what the hell do I do with all the space? And I have some examples, like I live in Basel, as you said, where we have two pharmaceutical companies. One of them is Roche. They've just built a huge high-rise with Herzog de Meuthen, and now they're building the second one. It's actually in construction. Every day I see like a floor going up. And I met their architect, and he told me, you know, if I could, I would stop that building right now. We don't need so much space because we will have a completely different mix. We will do more shared desking. We will maybe not bring everybody to Basel who could work from elsewhere. We will maybe have, you know, 2 days from home and 3 days in the office. I don't need that much space.
Nora Felbaum, the CEO of Vitro, speaking to Monocle's design editor, Nolan Giles. Well, that's all for this special edition of The Urbanist from the Chiefs Conference here in St. Moritz. Today's episode was produced by Carlotta Rebello and David Stevens. David also edited the show. And to play you out of this week's episode, well, here's Kaiser Chiefs with "Don't Just Stand There, Do Something." Thank you for listening, City Lovers.